From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nobel Prize winners Alva and Gunnar Myrdal first became known in Sweden for their controversial views on contraception, sex education, and family planning. So the eyes of their country were on them when they had their first daughter. On today's Fresh Air, we meet that daughter, Sissela Bach. She's a philosopher and the author of books about lying and telling secrets. Her new book is a memoir about her mother. Also, New York Times religion correspondent Ari Goldman tells us about the year he spent at Harvard Divinity School in search of God. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of Paul Scott, the author of The Raj Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ethiopian rebel forces have taken the capital city, Addis Ababa, after a fierce assault on the presidential palace. Most government troops appear to have fled the city, with only small pockets of resistance remaining. Peter Biles filed this report for the BBC from the Ethiopian capital.
There's been no celebration so far in Addis Ababa as the rebels attempt to mop up any remaining pockets of resistance from members of the presidential guard. Sporadic shooting was still being heard as darkness fell this evening. Despite the heavy gunfire and cannon fire this morning, the rebel takeover now seems to have been achieved with relative ease. Inside the palace compound this afternoon, I saw a large number of government tanks which had been completely burnt out and wrecked. The government soldiers who had fled had stripped off their army uniforms, including their boots, and left them scattered on the ground. The palace buildings were not noticeably damaged, but the nearby headquarters of the old ruling party has been burnt down.
Peter Biles in Addis Ababa. Kremlin envoy Yevgeny Primakov has come to Washington to ask for American financial assistance and support for the struggling Soviet economy. The Soviets are asking for the financial help in return for speeding up Soviet reforms. Primakov, an advisor to Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, will meet President Bush's top economic advisor, Michael Boskin, tomorrow. He'll also see Secretary of State James Baker. During his three-day visit, Primakov plans to see officials from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to talk about possible Soviet membership in those groups. President Bush said today that the United States and the Soviet Union are approaching agreement on a conventional weapons treaty, making it possible for a summit meeting early this summer. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush spoke to reporters after 18 holes of golf in Kennebunkport, Maine. He said he had a very good conversation about arms control last night with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Although the U.S. and Soviet Union already signed a treaty on conventional weapons in Europe, disagreements remain over what forces are included. The administration wants to see that matter resolved before it will commit to a date for another superpower summit this summer. Mr. Bush said no dates have been set for a summit, but one could be held sooner rather than later. The president also said he is looking forward to receiving a special emissary from Gorbachev who will report on Soviet plans for economic reform. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Supreme Court has given a setback to the Iran-Contra prosecutors. The High Court let stand a ruling by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that Oliver North may not have received a fair trial. The lower court had ruled that North's conviction cannot stand if independent counsel Lawrence Walsh used the colonel's testimony, which was given to Congress under a grant of immunity. On Wall Street, stocks closed up today. The Dow's advanced nearly 45 points to close at 2958.86. Advances led declines in moderate trading. This is NPR. Convicts at a prison for New York's most dangerous criminals are holding four hostages now. SWAT teams are reportedly using tear gas to try and put down the uprising. State officials say negotiations have begun with 52 inmates of the Southport Correctional Facility. One hostage who was released earlier had been badly beaten and has been hospitalized. Authorities say no force has or will be used against the prisoners while negotiations continue. A senior Israeli official says Israel is not negotiating with the pro-Iranian Hezbollah group for a prisoner exchange. But Israeli sources say a deal is in the works. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's coordinator for activities in South Lebanon, Ori Lubrani, denied Israeli press reports that Israel has already begun negotiating with Hezbollah for a prisoner exchange. The press reports came after statements by newly elected Hezbollah leader Abbas Mousawi that his organization holds two missing Israeli servicemen and will trade them for hundreds of Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Lubrani said Israel is willing to negotiate, but it must first have information on all seven of its missing servicemen, including those held by other Arab groups. Hezbollah is also believed to hold 13 Western hostages, and Lubrani said he hoped that the Israeli and Western hostages would be freed at the same time. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Pentagon says that about 85,000 Kurdish refugees have gone back to their homes in Duhok in the past 5 days. This brings the total number of displaced Kurds who've gone home to about 100,000. The National Association of Realtors says low mortgage rates spurred a jump of 3.4% in the sales of existing homes in April. This is the highest level of existing home sales recorded since last August. Home sales rose across the country, except in the Midwest, where sales were unusually strong the month before. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sissela Bock, is best known for her books on the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her new book is more personal. It's a memoir about her mother. Bock is the daughter of Gunnar and Alva Myrdal, the only husband and wife to each win a Nobel Prize in different fields. He won for economics. She won the Peace Prize for her work on disarmament. Many of the dilemmas women are facing today, Alva Myrdal faced and wrote about in the 1940s and 50s. She had a career of international scope while raising three children. Myrdal was one of the architects of Sweden's family and social policies. She was Sweden's ambassador to India and head of the UN's Department of Social Affairs. Her responsibilities often took her away from her family. Sissela Bock was born in December of 1934, just about a month after the publication of her parents' controversial book, Crisis in the Population Question. The book put her parents at the center of national debates about families, contraception, and child care. And all of Sweden seemed to be interested in how the Myrdals would bring up their own children. Sissela's birth was covered in the Stockholm newspapers.
They regarded it as something of a scandal because the book was something of a scandal. Here was a woman who was actually signing her name to a book that talked about sexuality, about family planning, contraceptives, all kinds of things that in those days, Puritan Sweden did not think women should be talking about at all, preferably not men either.
Do you think your mother was self-conscious about how she brought you up, knowing that she was in the public eye?
I think she cared a lot about bringing up children, but I don't think the fact that she was in the public eye altered how she was doing it. She had established a school for training nursery school teachers, and she cared a great deal about how one might raise children to be happier individuals, and in particular how one might raise girls not to develop all the feelings of incompetence and weakness that she saw so many girls having. And of course, she herself had been brought up to think that she couldn't do all kinds of things because she was a girl and she shouldn't really try to do them.
Did she do things differently with you than other mothers of the time did with their daughters so that you wouldn't feel inferior by virtue of being a woman?
It certainly seemed that way, both to my sister and to myself. We had a sense that our upbringing was just much freer in many ways. And we knew that other people looked at us, in fact, as rather badly brought up because we didn't really always act just the way little girls were supposed to act. We didn't seem to care enough about dolls and we didn't seem to care enough about pretty clothes, for instance. So we did know that there was a difference, but we always thought that we were very well off in that sense.
Your mother became a writer and a thinker at a time when there were very few women who were doing that and also having families. And she was really way ahead of her time in having to figure out how to have both a career and a family. And you write about how all the women who she knew of who were scholars never married and never had children. So they didn't have to make those kinds of choices.
Right. I mean, those were the women that she did admire for having done something with their lives. But on the whole, they had no children, even if they had been married, and most of them definitely had not married either. And she just knew that she wanted to have a different kind of life. She really did want to have a family very much. She did want to have children. But she had absolutely no models that she could think of for women who had done both and done so creatively. And in her own family, her mother in particular, was very afraid of sexuality and afraid of having children, in part because her mother had died in childbirth at the age of 31. And so my mother's mother, terrified in this way, actually had 5 children, but was very resistant to the whole idea and spent a lot of time, especially later in her life, in bed, partly so as to avoid her husband and all kinds of family responsibilities. And my mother was just sure that she didn't want to lead her life that way. But that's where family planning came in again, and contraception. She didn't want to be in the situation where she might end up having innumerable children. She wanted to be able to have a life in which she could decide when the children would fit in and how that would work with being employed. But of course, then she found out that however carefully you plan, there are many, many complications about trying to do both.
Well, early on in her life as a mother, she made a decision that I think she was always unsure about, that she always in some ways regretted. This was before you were born, but your mother's first son, Jan, or is it Jan?
Jan,
thank
yes.
you. Mm-hmm. He was 2 years old when your mother had the opportunity to go with your father to New York. For research?
Yes.
And she decided to go and to leave her son at his grandparents' house in the country, thinking that that would really be good. But what was the problem?
Well, the problem was that you know, obviously it cut her links in many ways with this little boy, and she knew in her heart of hearts that she shouldn't perhaps have left him. On the other hand, she was dying to go to America. She and my father had both been offered fellowships to study in this country, and that was very unusual at the time. She was 27 years old, and she was terribly torn. And my father insisted that she come without the little boy. And nowadays, you know, I think it would have been much easier to think through the problem and to think of all we know now about that 2-year-old stage when children really need to bond in a way with their parents. And I think most of us would not make the same choice. But she was very torn. She later thought it had been a terrible mistake, but she did it at the time. And once she came to America, she loved her opportunity to study and do research.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sissela Bach, and she's the author of books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. I think our view of relationships is often framed by watching our parents and by watching the kind of conflicts they have with each other. Now, your mother watched her parents' battles about the conflict between sexuality and having more children. Your mother didn't want to, your grandmother didn't want to just keep having more children, and she was very wary of having sex because of that. What were the battles between your parents that you watched and that helped frame your idea of relationships?
Well, one, and perhaps the most important, probably had to do with how one relates to one's children. I could see that there was my mother struggling so hard both to have close relationships and indeed friendships with her children, and on the other hand also help and be close to this man who demanded fantastic amounts of attention, and that was my father. And he was in many ways, she always thought, a genius, and a genius required very special kinds of help. He was temperamental, he could be depressed, he could be elated. She knew how much she could help him, and she knew that he essentially wanted her all to himself, and he did not want her to spend very much time at all with the children. In fact, though he was a feminist, and I think that's very important for me to stress, he always supported her work, and he always supported other women who wanted to do things. But at the same time, he did not think that they should have children. He thought that a bright, talented woman should dedicate herself totally to her work, and if there was a husband, also to the husband, but not particularly to the children. And seeing that, I just knew that I could never lead that kind of life. I'd rather not marry at all than marry someone who demanded that kind of divorce from my children, from me. And of course, she didn't carry it out either. She really tried to do everything. She didn't succeed always, but I think she did pretty well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sissela Bach, and she's best known for her books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. Her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sissela Bach is my guest. Her new book is called Alva Myrdal, A Daughter's Memoir. Your mother wrote that children should feel free and strong and able to resist their parents. How did she feel when you rebelled against her?
I think that that, again, produced a little bit of a surprise for her, not one that made her angry. And in a way, we never rebelled in such a way as to want to make her angry. We went our own way, and I think she was very supportive of that because she specifically argued all the way through her youth and the years when she was talking about child psychology. She especially argued against the idea that children should be brought up to obey adults no matter what. So I think she was pleased in that sense. At the same time, she obviously thought sometimes that we could have gone in slightly different directions. And then she would always toss out thousands of ideas toward us, ideas about what to study, how to live, how to furnish whatever place we were living in. And that, in turn, was something that we appreciated enormously, I think. She never tried to force us, but she had all these ideas. In particular, I remember one time I talk about a young man that I had actually gotten engaged to at age 17. I now look back at that with some trepidation. At that time, instead of saying anything about the fact that I might be too young or that he might not be the right husband for me forever and ever, she took me instead on one of her trips to England, and we visited Oxford and Cambridge universities, and I ran into a lot of other young men, and I began to put my situation in perspective. But she never, never forced even that situation.
What were the things that you rebelled about in your relationship with your mother?
There was a time, especially in adolescence, when I felt that her brand of competence and being so sensible and knowing so much seemed to shut out what I thought was very important about emotions and poetry and light and darkness and secrets, as I wrote. It didn't seem to me that she spent enough time at all in the almost magical garden where we lived in Geneva. And I just had a kind of dream life that I didn't think she shared. So I wrote in my diary at one point that I never wanted to share her values. As I now look back at that, I realize that I didn't really see her fully at that time, 15, 16, 17. But on the other hand, I think I had to go through that phase before understanding her more fully.
How did your relationship with your mother change when you became an adult?
Well, what happened was I was living in Paris with her when I was 18 and 19. And as I say, I was in this rather sulky mood, but so many things were happening in Paris at the time. The French were winding down their brutal war in Vietnam. There were street battles in which I saw people, Vietnamese and others, bleeding. There were all kinds of marvelous singers like Juliette Gréco. So many things were happening in Paris that I began to think I needed to talk with her about it in spite of my resistance. And then I met, when I was 19, I met Derek Bach, who would then shortly become my husband. And again, I had a sense that now I wanted to share something with her. This was something so extraordinary. And perhaps, after all, I had to grow up. And if I were to grow up, I knew that I would have to have a different kind of relationship with her. Even then, however, I was a bit tentative. And it wasn't until after I had married, and in fact moved to America, and she had gone to India, that my husband asked me how it could be that I was still on a somewhat tentative relationship with her. And then I wrote her, a letter where essentially I asked her to forgive me for not having understood her enough. And I think that was an enormous turning point in my relationship with her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sisala Bach, and her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal. Your parents, before they died, drew up a will that willed all of their money to a foundation for artists and writers. And as you write in your book, they didn't believe in inherited wealth. I wonder how you felt about that, and how you felt, too, knowing that that money wouldn't go to your grandchildren. I mean, to your children, to your parents' grandchildren.
Yes, at the time, I must say, when I heard about this, my father wrote me, and it seemed to me that my parents had every right to do what they wanted. They were not in any sense millionaires, and they had every right to do with the money that they had earned, having started out with nothing in their own lives, or very little. So at the time, that seemed perfectly reasonable, and they had always been enormously generous, and continued to be so, in fact, with all the grandchildren. So there was no sense at the time that there was a problem. And most of all, I think, like most people probably, I did not want to think about such things as their passing away and their having a will. It was later that the problem arose, when it turned out that this foundation, called a Universal Heir, as I recall, also had received all the photo albums, all the books, all the mementos. And that, we felt, was really a problem, because we wanted to save some of those for ourselves and very much for the children. So then we had to go and ask permission of the Universal Heir, who graciously allowed us to go into the storage vault and select things for our children and take away the photo albums and other mementos. And that was problematic, and in a sense that made me realize that I wasn't going to do things quite that way myself.
Your parents both lived into their early 80s, and you write that in the 1980s there were several magazines that did feature articles about your parents, and that these articles created false pictures of your parents' bliss together in their latter years.
Yes, at the time, by that time, my parents had obviously, you know, they'd had many separations, they'd gone through all kinds of ups and downs. They were very supportive to one another in so many ways, but my mother had also had to carve out an existence of her own. So when all these magazine interviews came around and all these headlines suggesting that here was this couple and they were so blissfully happy and they just loved every moment together, my mother felt that that was a false image that was being projected. My father always was very willing to, I mean, he half believed it all, so he was very willing to make it sound that way. And my mother could not at that point very well say, wait a little, to the interviewer, wait a little, by the way, we have our problems too. That didn't seem to fit with her idea of the diplomatic person that she was. So there was a sense of a false mask. And part of what I'm doing in the book, really, is to do what I think she wanted, namely to show that underneath that mask, there was this living, breathing human being who, in fact, you know, was not just part of the perfect couple, or the totally accomplished woman who had it all, but an actual human being who had many ideals, many problems, many tensions, and who managed to work many of them out.
Well, speaking of removing the mask, your older brother had written a memoir about your parents that was very negative. I haven't read it. I've just read what you've said about it. But, you know, your mother and father left your older brother for a year, left him with his grandparents when he was two so that they could do research in New York. And I don't know if that contributed to his feelings toward them or not, but I wonder what effect it had on the family to have a memoir that put them into a pretty bad light as parents.
That was a very, very sad time in their lives. My brother had already broken with them in 1967 when my mother was 65, and explained that he really couldn't take any more the tensions, especially with my father and my father's way of very aggressively sometimes teasing him. And my brother had just decided that he had had enough of that. So they were not seeing one another. But I don't think my parents had expected that he would publish this book, which he called Childhood, where he essentially says that not only was there a problem with my father, By the way, it's a novel, but it uses their names.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Yes. Not only was there this problem with my father, but my mother had been a cold and most unpleasant, most unmotherly parent. My mother learned about that book in the fall of 1982, and it actually appeared just during the same weeks when she found out that she had received the Nobel Prize for Peace. She was 80 years old then, and there she was with her highest ambition in life almost, named having to do with peace, being recognized in this way on the one hand, and on the other hand, her highest ambition in her private life having to do with the family, and when those two seemed to clash so completely. And it was shattering for her. It was very, very hard, and I do talk about that.
Did you ever talk to your brother about it?
I did. I tried many times to have a reconciliation between my brother and my parents. It never worked. And I think both my brother and I have come to the conclusion, after thinking through our various respective books, that we did have very different childhoods. I came along 7.5 years later, and I did not experience what he experienced, and I can't know what he experienced. So in a way, in the book also, I try to be careful not to say what I think about his childhood, but rather to quote him and to quote the various headlines about his book that had quite a devastating effect on my parents.
Why did you want to write this book about your mother?
I wanted to write it in part because of those events that had made her feel that she was not understood in the right way. Most people in Sweden at the time thought she was almost a saint, this woman who has won all these prizes and who does everything so well and who has this perfect marriage and who can do it all. Then there were some people who were very critical. My brother was one, and the headlines made her seem almost like a half-demon. And then there were other people who thought that she was a cold, calculating social engineer. Nothing seemed to fit. And she began to think what she had never thought before, namely that she should write her own memoirs. And just then, she, however, was developing a form of aphasia, of not being able to speak properly and not being able to write properly. So that just when she was getting ready, in a way, to write her memoirs, she became unable to do so. And she told me in 1984, in the summer of 1984, when I was visiting, that she worried about this, and she said, "What happens if I can't explain anything anymore?" And that's the sentence that my book begins with, and that's the sentence that really set me thinking, maybe there's something I can do about helping in this explaining process. I know I can't do it as she might have, but I might just try anyway. And that's how I started what I think of now as a dialogue, really, but a dialogue with a person who could no longer speak. So it had to be with her letters, her writings, her diary materials that she had given to me, and everything else that I could lay my hands on.
Sissela Bach, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Sissela Bach's new book is called Alva Myrdal, A Daughter's Memoir. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
After 10 years at the New York Times, reporter Ari Goldman had been exposed to corruption, murder, drug addiction, and disease. But all that was nothing compared to the anxieties he had when he decided to enroll for a year at the Harvard Divinity School. By then, Goldman was a religion correspondent and was wondering how his own faith fit in the scheme of things. Coming up, a talk with Ari Goldman. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new biography of Paul Scott, the author of The Jewel and the Crown and the other novels in the Raj Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Rebel groups from Ethiopia have agreed to form a temporary government. The plan was agreed upon during talks in London with a U.S. mediator. The conference had been organized in an effort to end the civil war in the country, but the government delegation boycotted the meeting. Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The talks ended after only 2 days. Assistant Secretary of State Herman Cohen announced that the three rebel groups participating in the talks had agreed to the formation of a provisional government. The outgoing Ethiopian government withdrew from the talks overnight in protest at the U.S. recommendation that the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, the EPRDF, take over the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. According to Cohen, the new government will be broad-based. Details of how the government will function will be worked out at a conference to be held sometime before July 1st. The groups invited the United States and other countries to act as observers. In the interim, the EPRDF will assume, in Cohen's words, state responsibility. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
Early this morning, rebel tanks moved into the capital of Ethiopia as thousands of rebel troops took the lightly defended city within 3 hours. In separate moves, Iran and Libya are trying to renew diplomatic relations with the United States. But the State Department has brushed them off, citing Iranian and Libyan support for terrorism. Barry Schweid has more.
Iran's leaders want to end the country's diplomatic and commercial isolation. They'd like to sell Iranian crude oil in the U.S. and are trying to raise billions of dollars for the Iranian economy. But the State Department is firm, citing the same two conditions that have guided U.S. policy for years. Iran must stop sponsoring terrorism, and it must use its influence with hostage takers in Lebanon to secure the release of 6 Americans. Libya's overture in a public statement got even shorter shrift. Its record on terrorism and its campaign to purchase weapons of mass destruction were the stated reasons for the turndown. When the Bush administration looked for allies against Iraq, it enlisted Syria, even though that country is on the State Department's terrorism list. And since the war, Secretary of State James Baker has made several trips to Damascus to try to interest President Hafez Assad in holding peace talks with Israel. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
For the second time in 2 days, there's been a bomb explosion in government offices in Peru. In the latest explosion, a small bomb went off in the transport and communications building, damaging the second floor. Home sales moved up to their highest level in April since last August. According to the National Association of Realtors, low mortgage rates pushed up existing home sales by 3.4%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 45 points in only moderate trading. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says about 100,000 Kurdish refugees have gone back to the northern Iraqi city of Duhok. According to military spokesmen, some 85,000 people have gone back to the city over the last 5 days. As of this morning, more than 36,000 people were still in refugee camps. White House doctors are still wondering whether it's just a coincidence that both the president and Mrs. Bush developed the same thyroid condition, Graves' disease. The Secret Service has started testing the drinking water at the White House, Camp David, and the president's vacation home in Maine. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
The Secret Service is checking the water for iodine or lithium, natural substances sometimes linked to thyroid problems. But specialists say the test is really a long shot. It is very unlikely drinking water would contain enough of these substances to cause a problem, and neither one is commonly linked to Graves' disease. Vice President Dan Quayle first raised concern over water when he speculated that old lead pipes in the vice presidential residence, where the Bushes lived for 8 years, might have helped cause the thyroid condition. Lead, although dangerous, has never been linked to thyroid abnormalities. But the vice president's water will be checked along with the president's. Doctors are also examining the medical histories of the Bushes and their dog, Millie, who suffers from a different autoimmune problem, just to make sure there is no link. I'm Michael Scholar in Washington.
In Canada, the government says that overall crime in the country jumped 7% last year, for the largest increase in 10 years. However, at the same time, drug-related crime was down some 8%. The Government of Canada says more than 2.6 million non-traffic offenses were reported in 1990. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Unlike many assimilated Jews in America, Ari Goldman never had to search for his roots. He grew up in an observant Orthodox home, and today in his early 40s, Goldman is still a practicing Orthodox Jew. After nearly a decade at the New York Times covering transportation, suburban life, education, and crime, Goldman became the Times' religion correspondent. And after a year writing about religion, Goldman decided he needed to know more about the religions of the world. So he took a sabbatical to study at Harvard Divinity School. That year is the subject of his new memoir, The Search for God at Harvard. Not everyone in his family was enthusiastic about his open-minded investigation of other religions. His great-aunt Minnie advised him not to go.
Aunt Minnie is a great old lady in her 90s, probably closer to 100 now, who was a little worried about my studying other religions. And her advice was, don't go, basically. She said, what more do you need to know? If you know Judaism, that's it. After all, Judaism is the best.
She said to you, remember, you can study all the religions of the world, but Judaism is the best.
Yeah.
What do you think of that advice?
I know where it's coming from. I was brought up with that idea that there is no need to look elsewhere, that all the truths are in my own faith. And especially during the 60s, when people were running off to gurus and experiencing Eastern religions, you always heard traditional Jews saying, but all that's within Judaism. There's the Kabbalah. There's a mystical tradition in Judaism. You don't have to look elsewhere. We've got it all, and we've got the truth. So Aunt Minnie's advice really came out of that that worldview.
Do you buy that worldview?
Well, I was brought up with it and embraced it and understood the world like that. Certainly the notion of chosenness makes somebody want to believe that Judaism is the only path. Part of my experience of going to Harvard Divinity School was seeing that there are a multitude of paths.
A lot of American Jews have been brought up with an almost superstitious fear of things Christian. You fall into that category.
Very much.
Give me some examples of the kind of fear you were brought up with about Christianity and Christian practices.
Well, if you pass a church when I was a kid, there was this feeling that you got to walk fast because somebody might nab you, that the whole purpose of Christianity is to convert, is to win Jewish souls and turn you into little Christian souls. So that fear of Christianity and the fear of looking elsewhere was very much a part of my upbringing.
You were told Jews don't kneel, and you were discouraged from falling on both knees at the same time.
That's right. That was one of the lessons of summer camp, and I went to very Orthodox summer camps that were almost an extension of the yeshiva life that I had the rest of the year. And the idea of not getting on your knees was a very powerful one. That's what Christians do. It even extended to, somebody reminded me the other day, when we were kids, we used to break the crosses off of chess pieces on the king because, after all, how can you have a cross in your house? That's going a little far, but I remember that was one of our ways to stay apart from the Christian world. And that was reinforced every day in yeshiva. I had a teacher, a math teacher, who wouldn't make crosses for plus signs. He insisted on making some sort of T because he said, what if I erase the board and I forget to take off one of the plus signs, somebody will think I'm teaching Christianity. So this fear of of Christianity was really strong.
Where do you think that comes from?
Oh, I think it's in some ways it's very well founded. I think it comes from 2,000 years of persecution, and I can say that without claiming a persecution complex on the part of Jews. I don't think that's what this means, because history really bears out that, you know, the Inquisition, the Crusades, I mean, right up to the Holocaust, and after all, I was born just a few years after the end of the war, so that Holocaust mentality and fear was very much a part of my worldview growing up, that there is that they're out to get you.
I'm sure your parents and your rabbis never encouraged you to go to church. Yet, as part of your job as a religion reporter, I'm sure you go to churches with some regularity to understand what's happening inside. Can you give us a sense of what the experiences for you have been like of going to churches, and how that experience has changed over the years as your sense of religions has broadened?
I went into church on assignment the first time. Really went because I had to cover a black preacher in Brooklyn, and there was something, you know, because of the tradition, the Jewish Christian tradition, there was something that was familiar about this experience. At the same time, there was something very scary and alienating. So I went into churches the first few times, and I'm sure other Jews have had this experience, especially in Catholic churches, when people kneel and get up and get down and go up for communion. Like, what are you supposed to do? What's the right thing to do? But I always felt like an outsider in church. I always felt like I didn't belong there. And there was this little voice inside of me, and it was very influential Rebbe, one of my teachers in high school named Rabbi Siegel, who would always, who would appear to me in church and say, "What the hell are you doing here?" But he wouldn't use the word hell. He would say, "Get out. You're not allowed to go into a church. If the whole world is on fire and this is the only refuge, you don't belong here. Look at that cross. Do you know how many Jews died in the name of that cross? Out, out, out of the church." That is something that plagued me. And what I would do is pull the notebook out of my pocket and say, "But look, look, Rebbe, I'm not here because this is a religion. I'm not here for faith. I'm here just like the electrician who comes in, or the guy who paints the building. I'm here doing my job, and don't worry, I'm not going to succumb. I'm not going to let them nab me. I'm not going to become part of this." And that's how I approached churches for a very long time, with the reporter's notebook almost as a shield. Like, here, I'm here for my craft. I'm not here for any kind of religious experience.
Do you still have that terrible sense of discomfort when you're in a church?
No, I have. And I want to assure your listeners that I'm still an observant Jew. But I go into church and I feel a sense of awe. I feel, and this really came out of my experience at Harvard, I feel that this is something that can enrich me without my being part of it. I can go to a gospel service and love the music. I can be moved emotionally to a height that I would rarely feel in a synagogue. I can go to a Quaker service, and those of your listeners who've been at Quaker services know you just sit and you wait for the Spirit to move someone, and there's such peace and such serenity in that just act of sitting, and you close your eyes and you think, you just let thoughts run through your mind, and suddenly someone will stand up and say a blessing and sit down, and someone else will stand up and say something else that comes to them. Well, that sense of serenity is something rarely felt in a synagogue, and because there's so much movement and discussion and liturgy that kind of gets in the way from those moments. But I could take a bit of that back to the synagogue with me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ari Goldman. He's religion correspondent for The New York Times and author of a new memoir called The Search for God at Harvard. It's about his sabbatical year studying the religions of the world at Harvard Divinity School. It's also a personal memoir about his own faith. We'll take a short break and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ari Goldman, religion correspondent for the New York Times, is my guest. There's a movement today in many religions and many different sects within the religions to add new rituals, to reform old rituals in order to make them more relevant. And I think women and gays in many ways have been at the forefront of this because they've been so excluded from an equal role in religions. As an Orthodox Jew, I wonder how you feel about that and if you're for opening up the religion like that. And I should mention, while you were at Harvard Divinity School, there was the Gay and Lesbian Caucus mm-hmm. and the Women's Caucus. You know, even at the Harvard Divinity School, people who were looking for new ways of practicing old religions were a large percentage of the student population within the school.
Yes. I am in the have the distinct advantage of being able to go around saying I'm an Orthodox Jew without being a rabbi. If I was a rabbi, I'd have to answer for everything that Orthodoxy does, and I'd have to uphold it and teach it. I have the pleasure of being somebody who draws great sustenance and enjoyment and faith from Orthodoxy, but can look Orthodoxy in the face and say, it's not what it should be. It should be more. Now, getting to those other issues of women and gays, I think there, too, Orthodoxy has to open up. It has to acknowledge the role of women in Judaism. It has to come to terms with the fact that they have been really oppressed in the Jewish home, in the traditional Jewish home, that they are not given full equality in the synagogue, is something that Orthodoxy should explore. I'm not saying they should tear down the machitza, the barrier between men and women, and let women participate equally, at least not initially, but they should understand, they should explore the reasons for those laws and try within the tradition to give women as much of a role as possible.
But not yet equality, huh?
I don't think Orthodoxy is ready for it. There are Orthodox rabbis, they're considered left-wing and radical, who give women their own Torah. That is, the men have a service, and the quorum of 10 men makes a minion. That is, 10 men make the quorum, the minion. They can pray, but there's no reason why not to say, women, you take a Torah and you pray and have your own service. When you have 10 people there, to give women, that's that kind of equality. Whether they could be brought together is something that conservative and reform Judaism has done or is in the process of doing, and more so in conservative Judaism. Because then you get to the question of the woman as rabbi, the woman as religious witness, that Orthodoxy has to struggle with from its point of tradition. I mean, after all, what makes it Orthodox is that it has a tradition that goes back to Talmudic times. Now, that tradition has changed over the years. It isn't all written in stone, although parts of it are, but there's more flexibility, there's more life, there's more give and take in the tradition, I think, than the Orthodox allow.
What do you think are some of the pros and cons of being a religion reporter who is himself deeply religious?
I think it's good. It's good to have somebody who cares about religion, who feels strongly about faith, out there writing about religion. I've been a reporter for 15 years already, and I started when I got to the Times. I didn't want to write about religion. I had come from a yeshiva university, from a very Orthodox, Orthodox-oriented institution. And a lot of my early journalism had been writing about Jews. And I said, no, I'm going to shake all that off and write about the world. And I covered transportation and education and state politics, suburban life. But I never, and I was able to go and out and cover a story and cover it well and, you know, cover it with feeling and understanding. But I never cared as much about things that I wrote until I began to cover religion. Because religion is such an important part of my life, I can go into a church, as I was saying before, and understand how the people there feel, or at least I can understand the importance of religion in their lives. I can't always understand what their particular religious experience is, because I believe it's different than my own. But I can understand that this is something so important to their core. And that comes back with me to the office. When I sit down and write, I want to explain that experience to my readers. And I think that's a lot more important than explaining why a politician says something or why a subway car doesn't work, which is what I did in my earlier reporting. So being somebody of faith makes my my reporting all that more intense.
Ari Goldman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. I enjoyed it.
Ari Goldman is a religion correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new memoir, The Search for God at Harvard. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll have an update about Ethiopia, where the largest rebel faction is taking control of the capital city there at the behest of the U.S. mediator in London. A political scientist at UCLA, though, says he's worried about government troops who may continue fighting. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Germany. On 7 months after unification and after 40 years of separation of the two Germanies, deep divisions still divide the people there. He visits three locations in the new Germany. Also, Tom Manoff reports on the 40th anniversary of the Marlboro Music Festival and a new CD released in honor of Marlboro.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're trying to untangle the politics of modern India, the Raj Quartet can provide you with some background. The four novels by the late British author Paul Scott are about the final days of British colonial rule in India. You may have seen the TV adaptation of one of the books, The Jewel and the Crown, which first aired in this country in the early 80s. There's a new biography of Paul Scott. Book critic John Leonard has a review and a remembrance.
I met Paul Scott in 1977 at an Indian restaurant in Manhattan. He was on his way to Oklahoma. I'd just published a celebration of his Raj Quartet in the New York Times. He was dying, and the rest of us knew it. And it's bitter to remember that his books weren't selling, his wife had left him, the British Arts Council had turned down his applications for a grant, he was living on the cigarettes he chain-smoked and the vodka bottles in his briefcase, and a semester teaching stipend from the University of Tulsa. 3 years later, 2 years too late, Granada Television discovered his novels. Reading Hilary Sperling's splendid biography, I wonder whether any masterpiece is worth so much unhappiness. From the beginning, in 1929, Scott must have felt himself an outsider, the child prodigy of a working-class mother and a fashion illustrator father, in a half-snobby, half-seedy London suburb. Walking and talking at age one, dismissed from school at age 14 when the money ran out, dreaming his way through Zola, Hardy, and Oscar Wilde, and listening to Ravel and Tchaikovsky, and writing unpublishable poetry and plays, while he clerked for an accountant. In the army for World War II, his homosexuality was discovered and used to threaten him. What he did then, apparently, was to repress it for the rest of his life, to marry and to burn. That same army sent him to India for 3 years. "I don't think a writer chooses his metaphors," he said. "They choose him." India chose Scott. He would return to London as a literary agent, handling clients like Muriel Spark and John Fowles. He'd also return with an amoebic infection that afflicted him for 20 years through 8 indifferent novels, until he wrote The Jewel and the Crown. But by then, he was taking a quart of booze to his monastic cell each morning, and there were horrifying, suicidal blackouts, and he identified with Philoctetes, the archer in the Greek myth, with the stinking wound that never healed. 2 trips back to India, and a million words later, he had his masterpiece, and he had his death. Sperling explains everything while trivializing nothing. She sorts through the influences, from the picture of Dorian Gray and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, to Kafka and Joyce, from Stephen Spender to T.S. Eliot, from Thackeray, Scott's favorite 19th-century novelist, to Nabokov, his favorite 20th. we come to understand, from his own ego wounds, how he identified with children of mixed marriages and cultures, the Hari Kumars. And from his tortured sexuality, where he got his authority to imagine a Ronald Merrick, the Imperial cop. And from his mother and his wife, where he got his displaced sympathy for lonely, defeated, and stoical women. We visit the Hanging Gardens on Malabar Hill, the Towers of Silence where the Bombay Parsis lay their dead, the skull and snake of Shiva the Destroyer, the bronze god in a circle of fire. I wish Sperling had taken his alcoholism more seriously. She seems to think of it as fuel for his art, or a substitute for sex. But this is often a blind spot in British biography. Otherwise, her book is a model. We get all the facts and are left with the mystery of transcendence. Scott's last whimsical booklet retold the Cinderella story, with Cinderella as a writer, the outsider, the outcast. Of course, the self-consuming circle of fire again. I'm glad I got to admire him in person. I'm sorry and bitter beyond words that he never got to see himself so famously on television.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Paul Scott, A Life of the Author of the Raj Quartet by Hilary Sperling. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Alex Chilton. As the singer with the Box Tops in the late 60s, Chilton recorded such hits as Cry Like a Baby and The Letter. He was still in his teens. His own subsequent bands had no commercial success, but those more personal records are the ones that influenced a lot of younger musicians. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.